Good morning. President Trump arrives in China to pomp, pageantry, and a warning.
They set it out that Taiwan could put the entire relationship between the two world's biggest economies in great jeopardy.
The AP speaks to us from Beijing. Also, why the White House's pitch for a gas tax break is running into some early dead ends. And just what exactly is a super El Niño? It's Thursday, May 14th. I'm Gideon Resnick. This is Apple News Today. President Trump received a lavish welcome as Air Force One touched down in Beijing. Trump shook hands with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping amid a military parade and was surrounded by crowds of flag-waving children. And when the two leaders came face-to-face inside the Great Hall of the People, Trump was effusive in his praise.
You're a great leader. It's an honor to be with you. It's an honor to be your friend. And the relationship between China and the USA is going to be better than ever before.
Xi delivered his own flattery, congratulating Trump on the 250th anniversary of the United States. But he also acknowledged their differences. He said the world had arrived at a crossroads and asked rhetorically whether the two countries could avoid conflict.
I was really taken by what seemed to me like a pretty sharp contrast in the two leaders.
Amr Madhani is a White House reporter for the Associated Press who's been traveling with the president. He told us that Chinese leadership was quick to press the issue of Taiwan.
What was really notable to me was that the Chinese government was very quick to come out with a readout after their meeting, and they went for about 2 hours. And in the government statement, they laid it out pretty bluntly. If it's handled properly, the relationship will be one of stability. But if it's not, they offer that there could be clashes and even conflicts.
China considers Taiwan a breakaway province that they will eventually control. The U.S., meanwhile, maintains unofficial relations with the island and is committed to providing it with military support. Its geographic location, and more recently, its dominance in chip manufacturing, makes it a strategically important place. It's also incredibly complicated. The U.S. says it doesn't support Taiwanese independence, but as President Biden's former China ambassador recently noted, declaring outright opposition would in itself be a language shift that could send shockwaves through the region. Trump's improvisational style on the world stage is therefore being watched closely. Madhani told us that Trump has rarely mentioned Taiwan in his second term, but had been especially ambivalent in the last few months.
On one hand, he's approved a $11 billion arms sale back in December, and that sale alone was the largest ever single arms sale approved to Taiwan. But the weaponry from that sale hasn't begun flowing. And since then, Trump has said that he's willing to talk to President Xi about that sale. And that in and of itself is a departure from historically what presidents have done in not discussing those sales with China.
The other topic people were watching closely was Iran, where China holds considerable influence. This morning, a White House readout of talks suggested that the two countries had agreed that the Strait of Hormuz should remain a free waterway, and that Iran shouldn't be able to exact payments for use of shipping lanes. Trump had downplayed any chance of Chinese involvement on Iran when speaking to reporters earlier this week.
Do you think he needs to intervene at all with the Iranians?
Do you think he can help in any way?
No, I don't think we need any help with Iran. We'll win it one way or the other. We'll win it peacefully or otherwise.
But in a Fox interview aboard Air Force One, Secretary of State Marco Rubio had said that he hoped China would try to use its influence on Iran.
Well, of all the countries of the world, economies are melting down because of this crisis in the Straits. They're going to be buying less Chinese product, and the Chinese exports are going to drop precipitously. So it's in their interest to resolve this. We hope to convince them to play a more active role in getting Iran to walk away from what they're doing now and trying to do now in the Persian Gulf.
In 2017, the two presidents met for dinner at Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate. There, over chocolate cake, Trump revealed to Xi that he had launched strikes on Syria. This occasion looks to be less eventful, and Madhani says the White House hasn't given any indication that any major announcements are coming. A large delegation of tech CEOs are with Trump, including Elon Musk, Apple's Tim Cook, and NVIDIA's Jensen Huang. But it remains to be seen whether the two countries might advance any business deals or extend their fragile trade war truce. As President Trump looks to help alleviate some pain for Americans at the gas pump, so far he's gotten a lukewarm response from some Republicans who he'd need to make it happen.
Well, I'm listening. I think right now, you probably know I've not in the past been a huge fan of previous attempts.
That's how Senate Majority Leader John Thune responded to a question Tuesday from reporters about the president's plan to suspend the federal gas tax. He went on to say that he'd be willing to hear the president's arguments on it. This conversation started when Trump pitched a suspension of the tax earlier this week.
It would be about 18 cents per gallon, or maybe less than that in practice.
Andy Pacone is a reporter with Politico's energy team.
But it's seen as one way that the administration can maybe soften the blow of the rising fuel prices we're seeing as a result of the war.
Republican Senator Josh Hawley introduced a bill that would suspend the tax for at least 90 days. The concept is not new, and in fact had been pitched by former President Biden before as a means of helping out the nation's drivers when prices go up. And some Democrats have been vocally supportive of a suspension recently as well. But Pacone reports that Republicans, by and large, haven't all leapt at the opportunity.
There isn't a whole lot of momentum behind that idea just yet. I think we're seeing members of Congress discuss it, you know, see what's viable, see if there's appetite for that kind of thing. But so far, it's been pretty slow.
In part, that's because of concerns about the Highway Trust Fund. That's a pool of money that's used on highway construction and other infrastructure projects. And lifting the tax, even temporarily, could have an impact on things those dollars pay for.
They don't want to be seen as defunding federal infrastructure projects, especially not just before the midterm elections later this year.
That's in some measure why Thune said that he was against the idea when Biden floated it in 2022 amid a price spike from the war in Ukraine. And he said that was also motivating his thinking now. Some trucking and construction industry trade groups have also pushed back for that reason. Pacone notes that some of the proposed legislation could find ways to make up the revenue difference. But there are also concerns about the impact on the federal deficit. He told us that many members of Congress are hoping for a resolution to the war as a means of dealing with inflation, rather than tampering with an important pool of federal money.
They really seem interested in having this war come to a close and bring prices down and dealing with the affordability issue that way, as opposed to trying to pass some legislation that could cause headaches for them on the House and Senate floor.
Yesterday, the Senate rejected the seventh attempt from Democrats to limit Trump's ability to use military force against Iran. But one more Republican, Senator Lisa Murkowski, joined her colleagues to vote in favor of moving it forward. That brings the number of Republicans willing to restrict Trump's war powers to three. Super El Niño is coming. That's the feeling of a widening group of meteorologists who think the chances are high that in the coming months, we will experience this major atmospheric phenomenon.
A super El Niño is basically when the waters in that part of the East Central Pacific rise about 2 degrees Celsius or about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit above average. So there's a warming in the ocean. And then the response in the atmosphere, because of how much warming there is in the ocean, can be stronger.
Ben Knoll is a meteorologist for The Washington Post. El Niños can impact weather pretty significantly around the globe, but when Pacific Ocean temperatures are exceptionally warmer, things get a lot worse. Knoll says that can cause climate patterns to be more persistent and longer lasting. And all these factors can have a big economic impact as the risk for extreme weather worsens.
I've been hearing on social media a lot from folks that live in India, concerned farmers about the monsoon there, agricultural production in that part of the world, very important. Other places like Australia, they tend to get quite dry. They had a couple of years ago during an El Niño, some horrendous bushfires, wildfires there. The U.S., you know, we're looking for big droughts in the south right now, but maybe later in the year, those could turn to floods and heavy rainfall across places that are currently experiencing drought. So you swing from one extreme to the other.
These so-called super El Niños have been devastating in the past. And this year's conditions are being compared to an especially bad one in 1877.
That event was preceded by big droughts around the world. And then the El Niño came, and it basically made everything much worse. So you kind of have these compounding risk factors, decisions made in different places around the world, governments at the time, and that basically led to global famine. And we had about 3-4% of the total population of the world die during that event.
Now, just because that was a devastating event doesn't mean the same outcome would happen now. Noel said today, we have the ability to track El Niños much more accurately compared to folks in 1877. And other economic and political factors that made that worse are different today, too. Still, it took until the early 1980s when another surprise super El Niño hit to revolutionize monitoring, tracking, and understanding of what weather conditions like this can bring. This week, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said there is a 61% chance of El Niño emerging and lasting through 2026. And Noel says that for the U.S., we could see the system peak this winter. Beyond that, a super El Niño could give us a preview of where climate might be heading in the future, as some climate scientists say that next year could be the hottest on record.
So it's not to alarm, it's not to scare, but it is, I think, a message of planning and preparing and being ready for something next year and later this year that could have a pretty strong effect around the world and link us all together.
Before we let you go, a few other stories we're following. Yesterday, the Senate confirmed Kevin Warsh to be the next Federal Reserve chair. Warsh was approved by a 54-45 vote, which is the smallest margin ever for this role. Pennsylvania's John Fetterman was the only Democrat to vote for him. That slim margin, Bloomberg notes, highlights the unusual partisanship injected into his selection to lead the Fed. Some Democrats fear that Warsh will rapidly reduce interest rates, succumbing to pressure from the president, though he vowed in his confirmation hearing to remain independent. For some historical context, Janet Yellen, President Obama's pick, earned 56 votes. Her predecessor, Ben Bernanke, was approved by a 70-30 vote. And before that, Alan Greenspan, who served five terms, was approved 91-2 in his first nomination. Warsh begins his term this month, and he's facing a tough economic outlook as prices for rent, gas, and groceries all spiked in April. The South Carolina Supreme Court on Wednesday overturned the double murder conviction of Alex Murdoch, a disgraced lawyer accused of killing his wife and son. The state's high court said a clerk in the county where Murdoch was tried engaged in, quote, shocking interference when she suggested to jurors that his testimony couldn't be trusted. The attorney general in South Carolina said he disagreed with the decision and will, quote, aggressively seek to retry Murdoch. The case drew national intrigue in 2023 as prosecutors claimed Murdoch killed his family to distract from alleged financial crimes he had committed. Murdoch won't walk free anytime soon, however, as he had also been serving time for separate financial convictions. His legal team said in a statement they look forward to a new trial. And FIFA has announced its headline acts at the World Cup's first ever Super Bowl-style halftime show. Madonna, Shakira, and the South Korean boy band BTS will perform in a show being curated by Coldplay's Chris Martin. It's being planned for the final in New Jersey's MetLife Stadium this July. And later today, Shakira will release her official World Cup song, Die Die. She posted a preview of the track on her social media last week. It's the second time that she's made an official song for the tournament. The scale of the halftime show has raised a few concerns for the purists. Soccer has a strict 15-minute break between halves, and this could push that back for the first time in a final. FIFA President Gianni Infantino wouldn't confirm the length, but said it would be, quote, a show befitting the biggest sporting event in the world. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the news app right now, we've got a narrated article coming up next. New York Magazine looks at how Delta Airlines morphed its company to a lifestyle brand to stay ahead, catering to elite customers. If you're listening in the podcast app, you can follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story. And I'll be back with the news tomorrow.